Next, I'm happy to introduce Joe Aaron, who made a Herculean effort to get here. So thank you for coming. He is a professor at University of North Carolina, going to talk about investigational approaches to antiretrovirals, new strategies.
Great. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Laura. That was nice. I drove up last night from Chapel Hill. I was driving 20 miles an hour on I-95. It was interesting. But, it's a learning experience. I'm from upstate New York. It was just everybody else I was worried about. I wasn't worried about me. All right. So I'm going to talk about investigational approaches to antiretroviral therapy and new agents. These are my disclosures, and I really try hard not to be biased. And so if you think I am, I'd prefer that I hear about it. My learning objectives have changed a little bit because of I didn't want to overlap with Dr. Thompson from yesterday. So I'm going to talk about two drug combinations that are being evaluated for initial and maintenance therapy with a focus on long-acting for the maintenance therapy. I'm going to describe some of the characteristics of these long-acting injectables and then talk about mechanism of actions and potential uses of new drugs, including entry inhibitors. Here's the outline of my talk, and I'm going to really jump right in. So I'm going to start with a question just to see where you guys are at. Basically. This is a simple question. There's no right answer. What is your go-to initial antiretroviral therapy? So if someone has a reasonable CD4 and a reasonable viral load and not a lot of other comorbidities or drugs, just pick what. Tell me what you pick routinely in your practice. Again, no wrong answer here. Wow, okay. Guess we have almost a consensus. That's fascinating. Terrific. All right. So why do we need new therapy, you might ask? I think it's possible that we really have terrific therapy. We have single tablet, safe therapy. We might need some alternatives to integrase. We don't see much integrase resistance being transmitted yet, but it could happen. The nice thing about bictegravir and dolutegravir is they're probably active against some of the simple single mutation integrase, so that might not be an issue. There's this question about integrase inhibitors and fat, which we're going to learn about, I think, more over the next year or two, whether they're associated with fat gain and whether that's bad or not. I think that the other issue is, well, do we really need to expose people to three drugs? What if two drugs are just as good? If someone's 25 or 30 years old, they're going to be treated for 50 years unless we come up with a cure. So maybe we should be exposing people to less drugs. And perhaps there are alternative dosing strategies, and I'll get into that. So two drug regimens for initial therapy. What's the rationale, right? For a while, we were talking a lot about nuke sparing or nuke light, right, to avoid TDF and maybe avoid abacavir. With TAF, it seems a little less critical now, but there's still patients who might benefit from two-drug therapy. I mentioned this issue about exposure. Maybe we need to expose people to less therapy. If we can use less, why not use less? It's an argument that some people make. And then there's the cost argument. Should we be, are we stewards of our health care? And especially in the Ryan White world, perhaps we should be using the least expensive, most effective therapy. And there have been a lot of different strategies. I'm only going to talk about one here. There's the boosted PI plus the integrase. And so far, that hasn't worked out as well as we had hoped. It's not all that convenient, and in a couple of studies, high viral load or low CD4 didn't do quite as well. Boosted PI plus 3TC, that actually has been studied in two relatively large comparative trials, both run by Pedro Kahn. But we're trying to move away, I think, from boosting stuff. We want to avoid boosters, blocking our hepatic enzymes for decades doesn't sound like a great idea. So we're left with integrase plus another agent, and what's been best studied is an integrase plus 3TC. So these are the Gemini data. Who has not heard of the Gemini study? Ah, a couple people. Good. The Gemini study, actually there are two of them, hence Gemini, I guess, and two drugs. These were two large randomized studies of dolutegravir plus 3TC versus standard dolutegravir TDF and FTC. And these were presented this summer and then again a couple weeks ago. And what you can see is they were virtually superimposable. So these were treatment-naive patients. They had to have a viral load less than 500,000. But the results were superimposable. So really kind of remarkable. The other thing I think that was surprising, at least to me, and I last year I asked of some of you that were here a question, is what if they're the same but there's more resistance? And then there was no resistance, none, in either arm. So this is, 500 people or more in each group and really no difference. So you might ask, well, what about the really high viral load? I bet the three drugs were better in the really high viral load. And these are the data we showed at the DART meeting just a couple weeks ago. And the numbers are really small, so you can't take a lot away from this. But there's no evidence that the two-drug therapy worked less well at high viral load than at low viral load. And in fact, there were a few people that were actually above 500,000 because their screening was below 500,000, but their entry was above. I think... again, they're only this is only 48-week data. This is not 96 or 148-week data. So it's a relatively short follow-up. But it is 700 patients in each arm. I think it's interesting. So here's your second question: based on what I just showed you, in what setting will you use dolutegravir 3TC? And you can see the choices. Would you use it as initial therapy in any viral load, as initial therapy in specific patients with lower viral loads? I'm only going to use it at maintenance therapy. I'm going to wait until there's longer-term data or only when insurance companies compel me to do it or something else. So go ahead and vote. I'm really curious for this answer. People want longer-term data. And you know what? That's exactly what I would have picked, too. So excellent. I think it's very encouraging. I also like the idea, Baba Femi Taiwo loves to talk about, we should be exposing people to less drugs. Well, you could expose people to three drugs for 6 months or 12 months and then go to two drugs. So that would be another approach. And that's being studied. Okay, so what about something completely different? What about long-acting therapy? So this is a combination of cabotegravir, which is a cousin to dolutegravir, and rilpivirine, something you really know well that you've, I'm sure, used. And this is basically a fairly large phase 2B study. So this is a phase 2B study. These were people who were treatment naive, but got suppressed on oral therapy, so they had to be suppressed on oral therapy, and then they were randomized, right? Randomized to either stay on their oral therapy or go on to these intramuscular shots. So these are long-acting intramuscular injections, either every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks in this particular study. And every 4 weeks, it's 2 mL of each intramuscularly. For every 8 weeks, it's 3 mL. Every 8 weeks intramuscularly. So these are injections in the muscle that have to be performed by a healthcare provider. You can see the criteria. They did have to add rilpivirine to their oral therapy for 4 weeks to make sure they tolerated it. There were over 100 people in the two injectable arms and then 56 people in the oral therapy arm. The randomization was when they were suppressed. So anybody who wasn't suppressed wasn't randomized. Randomization was when they were suppressed. And the primary analysis was at 96 weeks. And what we found, and I think was surprising, was that actually, again, this is a phase 2B study, not a phase 3 study, a phase 2B study. What they found was that 94% of the individuals who were randomized to have maintenance therapy on cabotegravir rilpivirine injectable every 8 weeks maintained suppression. And in the every 4 weeks, it was 87%, and on oral therapy, it was 84%. On the every 4 weeks, there wasn't a single person who had a viral load greater than 50 copies. There, all the 13% were due to discontinuing the therapy when they were suppressed. The major toxicity was injection site pain. Okay, that's the thing to remember. People do have pain. Most people have some pain. It does resolve over time. And it seems to be less over time in part because the person getting the shot is more relaxed. These are gluteal shots. And the person giving the shot is more relaxed. anyway, it was quite effective in a phase 2B trial. And now there are actually data now out to 160 weeks, and it's basically about the same. After 96 weeks, people could actually choose to go on every 8 weeks or every 4 weeks. Most people chose to go to every 8 weeks. They stayed suppressed over an additional 60 or so weeks. Some people chose to stay on every four. I'm not quite sure why you would pick that, but they did, and they stayed suppressed. And these are data from Scott Letender that was just published and presented in Glasgow, looking at CNS penetration. Because you might ask, well, what about CNS penetration? There's no nucleosides here. And what Scott found is that if you look at free drug for the cabotegravir, and those are the purple dots and the I don't know whatever that is, skin color. I'm terrible with colors, but I guess it's kind of tan or something. So CSF concentrations for cabotegravir were very similar to free drug concentrations in the plasma. So that looks the same. They didn't have that same metric for rilpivirine, but the concentrations in CSF with the rilpivirine component were actually well above the IC50 of the wild-type virus. So it looks like it penetrates. So where are we with this? There have been three now large phase 3 trials. ATLAS was looking at people suppressed on therapy, is looking at people who are suppressed on therapy for at least a year, if not longer, who are randomized to stay on their suppressed therapy or go to every 4 week shots, every 4 week IM shots. And this was a non-inferiority study. So that was one. A second one called FLARE looked at treatment-naive people who then got started on dolutegravir, abacavir, 3TC, or if they were HLA B5701 positive, they got to go on dolutegravir plus other nukes. And then after 20 weeks, if they were suppressed at 16 weeks, they were again randomized to stay on the oral therapy or go to the shots every 4 weeks. Now, you might say, why did they pick every 4 weeks when I just showed you that every 8 weeks looked pretty darn good? One, they were being conservative, and two, they didn't actually know the 96-week data when they designed these studies. And we know from a press release that non-inferiority was met. I don't know any data. You can go online. It is actually publicly available information. So what that means is you guys probably 6 to 9 months from now are likely to have these available to you. And then the third study is called ATLAS 2M. Those folks that were suppressed at 48 weeks on every 4 weeks plus the comparator arm plus additional people were randomized to stay on every four or go to every eight. So we'll get data on that too. So that's where we are with long-acting therapy. There are no data for long-acting therapy as initial therapy. Everybody in these studies were either on suppressive therapy or started on oral therapy. So keep that in mind. Okay, well, what about new therapies for resistant viruses? Some of you are old enough to remember that we once gave people a different type of injection, Fusion and Fuvertide T20, to block virus entry. Some of you probably have used Maraviroc, maybe not many of you, that also blocks virus entry. They work at different spots, but we now have two drugs, one approved and one in late-stage development, hopefully soon to be approved, that actually work at blocking the virus binding to the CD4 molecule. One is fostemsavir, the other is ibalizumab, and I'll talk about ibalizumab first. So ibalizumab is a mAb, and I guess it's a zoomab, so that means it's a humanized monoclonal antibody, I think. I learned that a few minutes ago. I was paying attention back there. It blocks entry by binding to the CD4 molecule, which you might think, boy, that sounds like a bad idea. Won't that mess up what CD4 does? But apparently doesn't. It just blocks virus entry. It's active against CCR5 and CXCR4 viruses. There's no cross-resistance, but it's an infusion, and it has to be given with a loading dose and then infused every 2 weeks. The duration of infusion is not very long, and it definitely works. It definitely works and is useful in patients with highly resistant virus that need a fully active agent. The good news is that's a pretty uncommon population. We have actually two people in our clinic of about 2,000 patients or so, 1,800 patients, that actually are on ibalizumab. Anyone here have a patient on ibalizumab? Yeah, so maybe seven, eight, Tony Mills probably has more than one. So it does work. It is useful. It has to be infused, obviously, in a clinical setting. These are the data showing that it certainly does work. A very small study, 40 patients, a phase 3 study with 40 patients. The reason why is this drug has been in development for like 15 years. The one patient that I have that's on it has actually been on it for 9 years in an open-label study, and the FDA was tired of having an open-label study lasting 9 years. So I think that's one reason why they allowed this relatively small. But it definitely works. But if you can't pair it with really active therapy, it doesn't work quite as well. Fostemsavir is a little different. Fostemsavir is an oral agent, so it's a pill. It's a pill that has to be given twice a day. It actually binds to the virus, not to the CD4 cell. So it binds to the GP120 of the virus, and it blocks attachment. So it's an attachment inhibitor. And one thing that you might remember is that the GP120 is the most variable part of the virus. So there's some risk here, right, that if you're going to bind to an extremely variable part of the virus, it might not work in everybody. But they did a large two-part study. They had a randomized cohort. And the way these studies work is basically you can't give people active drug versus placebo and optimized background for months at a time. That isn't ethical to give placebo to someone who has limited treatment options. So that's actually only done for 8 days. People will be on their standard regimen. They'll have the active drug fostemsavir started versus placebo. You prove that it has antiviral activity, and then you optimize therapy for everybody, and you allow those on placebo to get the active drug. In this particular study, in the randomized cohort, it was 3-1, so most people got active drug, even for those 8 days, and they had to have one additional active drug. And then there was a non-randomized cohort where patients who became participants had no fully active agents, and they weren't randomized. They were just given the drug plus the best therapy that their provider could come up with. And obviously, the randomized cohort was the cohort that was used for the comparison. And what they showed is that the drug has antiviral activity. So it's 600 milligrams twice a day. Over 8 days, it dropped the viral load by 0.8 logs, which is, you know, modest but clear activity. And then I don't know if I can point. Oh, beautiful. In the randomized cohort, what you can see is that if you looked at proportion less than 50, by week 24, it's almost 60%. If you went up here and looked at less than 200, it was almost 80%. So if you had a drug that was active and you added fostemsavir, you actually got a pretty good result. And even in those people that had no fully active drug, 42% were suppressed to less than 50. Now, that's not optimal. You don't want to add a single active drug when someone doesn't have other therapy. But on the other hand, if someone's CD4 is 50, you may not have a choice. So this drug has been submitted, I think, as I understand it, to the FDA. So we should hear sometime in the 2019 timeframe. And then these are just the 48-week data, basically showing 54% success, less than 40 copies. And then with the non-randomized cohort, it was down to 38%. So you do get, if you get someone suppressed, you get persistent activity. Okay, so that drug will be in your hands probably sometime in 2019, and may be useful in those patients with highly drug-resistant virus. So what about novel agents in early development? So these are things that you're not going to have maybe for several years, but are really kind of interesting. One is this MK-8591. This is an interesting drug. It works. It's a nucleoside, but it not only blocks reverse transcriptions, but it blocks translocation. So it actually blocks reverse transcription in two different ways. And what you can see here is that it's incredibly potent. This is in nanomolar, 0.2 nanomolar. That is extremely potent. And the only mutation that they've seen in vitro or in animals is M184V. This does select for M184V, but you can still see it's still very potent, even in the context of M184V. So it's a very, very active drug, which is good. And it's a very long-acting drug. So this is a study, you've seen these before, kind of proof of principle, where the drug is given for 7 days and you just see how active it is, and then the people go on fully a suppressive therapy of their choice. And you can see at 7 days, the drug has about anywhere between a 1 to 1.5 to 1.7 log effect. And you say, oh, that's good, we've seen this with other drugs. What you haven't seen is this is one pill once. This is not 7 days of therapy. This is a single dose. Suppresses the virus for out to 10 days. And it doesn't look like it's going up, so maybe even longer. Obviously, these people got started on therapy, so we don't know. So this is clearly an agent that can be given at really small doses. Notice the dose, 0.5 milligrams once, 1 milligram once. So you can imagine that this drug potentially could be formulated to be given as a very long-acting agent because it requires so little milligram dose. And there's a potential. This is another study in healthy volunteers showing that a dose as little as 0.25 milligrams, actually has sustained levels for over 24 hours. And it likely could be formulated as an injectable some sort of long-acting therapy. The issue is kind of partners wanted. It needs a partner, right? So it's, it went on, one of those dating websites to look for a partner. And this is from animals. So this is animals. This is a single parenteral formulation. It probably can be formulated in those rods like Nexplanon or Explanon. It probably could be formulated that way. This is actually an injection in rats. But you can see that a single injection lasting up to 200 days. So it is possible. So partners wanted. So this is a drug made by a different company. This is a capsid inhibitor. Capsid is, the thing that coats the virus, the protein shell that's inside the envelope of the virus. And the capsid is really important. The capsid kind of protects the virus as it moves from one cell to another. It actually, the capsid proteins are important for assembly and maturation. And then the capsid actually has to disassemble, come apart in an organized way so that the RNA ends up getting reverse transcribed and heads into the nucleus. And the capsid inhibitor actually works by blocking those three steps. So it's potentially a very useful drug. And it, too, is really potent. Here, again, the nanomolar EC50 is 0.1. So, 100 picograms or something like that. So, and it's active across multiple different subtypes, including, obviously, subtype B. And so it's another very active, potent inhibitor that works by an entirely different mechanism, a mechanism we really haven't seen yet. And again, if you inject this into rats or dogs, you can see that a very, very long half-life with a single subcutaneous dose. Again, potential. For this is a small molecule that could be delivered subcutaneously, or again, perhaps in a newer formulation that may have very long acting activity. So something potentially to look forward to. Originally, I had heard that this drug wouldn't be able to be formulated as an oral therapy, but apparently that's not the case. Apparently, it may be able to be formulated as an oral therapy. So it's something. Again, we have to look forward to, but it's kind of early days. So I think we're talking about maybe 3 or 4 years from now if all the hurdles have been surmounted, which you know can be a lot. Once you start giving things to people, stuff happens. It's not always what we hope for. And then finally, there's this kind of burst of scientific activity around these broadly neutralizing antibodies. So some really smart person figured out how to fish out specific B cells that make specific antibodies. So they could fish out of people these really highly active antibodies that really neutralize HIV broadly, across subtypes and at very high potency. And once someone figured that out, well, the fishing began, and now there are there's a lot of these broadly neutralizing antibodies. And the thing that's interesting about them is that you can modify them to make their half-life much longer. You modify the Fc portion in a way that's been worked out for other antibodies. And so some of them may be able to be infused every 3 to 6 months. Now, I kind of think of them, some people think of them as magic. I just think of them as another antiretroviral that can be maybe given lasting for a very long time and probably expensive to produce, and you'd have to give them by infusion. And you probably need to give more than one, almost certainly. Technology moves fast. Things become cheaper. Half-life becomes longer. So you could imagine what an infusion every 6 months. How might your patients go for that? They might not mind so much if it worked and had minimal side effects. And those are things we haven't learned yet. And there's this study that was just published by Michelle Nussensweig's group in New York City looking at these are people who are suppressed. They got two of these antibodies. And they found basically a couple things. One is that pre-existing viruses exist that are not sensitive to each of these antibodies. So by giving just two, they had a few people, which are over here, where the virus actually was resistant to one of the two antibodies. And you can see that these people did not stay suppressed very long. They rebounded very quickly. Now, they went back on therapy. They probably weren't harmed. What's interesting, though, is if they looked at people that had virus that was sensitive, and they looked retrospectively, not prospectively, they actually found that a fairly large proportion remained suppressed. And these are the what they saw with the antibodies given separately in the past, or no antibody. These are historical data here. This is a single antibody. And when they gave the two antibodies, you can see that people stayed suppressed on for 15 weeks. And you might notice that this line doesn't touch the bottom. There are actually two participants that have not yet rebounded. The antibody's gone out of their system, and they haven't yet rebounded. And my understanding is it's now out to about 48 weeks, and they have not yet rebounded. So the potential for these neutralizing antibodies is substantial. We have a timeline, and some of you have been here for this whole timeline, like me. We're in the integrase era, as you guys demonstrated with your very first question. We're giving single-tablet integrases. But maybe by next year, we'll be giving at least some people long-acting injectable therapy. And maybe by the middle of the next decade, we'll be using implantable ART in rods that can be removed or monoclonal antibodies infused every 6 months or longer than that. So that's where we're going. These are the people that help by giving me slides or giving me encouragement. Trip, telling me to wear nicer shoes, which I did. And I have time for questions, I think. Thanks.
Great. We have time for questions. I think one of the really interesting things in terms of those longer-acting therapies, if in fact we are going to start with getting them viral suppressed on oral agents right now, is that many places around the country have sort of these intensive clinics that are quite expensive to run, but they can get people suppressed. Just in the long term, it's hard to keep them suppressed. So if we could get them suppressed, Dr. Raffanti and Vanderbilt, they actually have a fabulous clinic that does that with really complicated patients or patients that have very complicated lives. And so the concept of then getting them suppressed in an intensive location and then meeting them where they are would be fabulous.
I think meeting them where they are is a great point. And thinking creatively, especially if we can do it every 8 weeks, I think, we could think creatively how to help some of these people that are having trouble adhering to care.
So sure. Sort of a follow-up to that is, in the setting that we're thinking about is, get people to suppress at this very intensive, almost two or three times a week, clinic-based or field-based intervention, but then going to a field-based Q 8 weeks. So my question is, what's the wiggle room on, I couldn't find them, but maybe I'll get them next week? I mean, that's the reality of what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So a couple of things that I didn't mention is one, the very first dose in every 4 weeks has to be 3 mLs instead of 2 because you want to load them. That every 4 weeks has, I think, a good plus minus 2 week interval, I think, for the every 4 weeks. For every 8 weeks, it's not certain. There were two patients, participants in the phase 2B trial that actually developed rilpivirine resistance. One was probably an injection malfunction, which is not like a wardrobe malfunction, but it's similar. They got an injection, it was documented, but there was no rilpivirine detected. So it may be that they injected on or near a vein, and therefore it went into the bloodstream. So there was really, resistance wasn't that common. The thing is that, at least in the study, I took the slide out, almost everybody was within 98% of the doses were in a plus or minus 7 day window because they're study patients. I think at least a week or maybe a little bit longer. The half-life in women is clearly different. It's longer in women. So I think we'll learn that, but you probably have a little bit of time. The thing that I would love is a point-of-care viral load, because I'd love to know that the person was suppressed before I injected them again. So that would be really useful.
Hi, Karen Beckerman. I don't see it as much as I used to, but are there these crisis situations. For example, a pregnant woman may be perinatally infected who just won't take pills, she won't take elixirs, or perhaps adolescents, other situations. For the agents or the drugs that may be available very soon or are already available, is there going to be a role for them in crisis control of viremia? Thanks.
Yeah, I think one of the things is if you add up all the people in all those studies, there are probably going to be about 3,000 or 4,000 people that have gotten these drugs. And one question is, does anybody have an acute reaction to them? And do you really need a lead-in? Do you really need to give cabotegravir or rilpivirine orally for X amount of time? You know, we don't do that for some long-acting things for psychiatric treatment because we have enough data to say that that's safe. I think it'll eventually be safe, and then potentially it could be used in those crisis situations. I don't know anything about PK distribution in pregnancy in that setting. I think this could potentially be very useful in adolescents. I think that may be a use for them. But, yeah, I think as it gets out there, people will start doing things exactly like that.
So a couple questions about rilpivirine if it's injected. Is there any concern about being on a PPI, and is there a food requirement?
No and no. Those are concerns about absorption. That's not oral absorption. That's not an issue.
Would you offer a patient infusion if they had no other active drug?
Yeah. You mean the, sort of like the ibalizumab infusion?
Right.
I think it depends on a person's clinical state, right? I mean, I would not do it if their CD4 was 300 or 400. I would put them on a holding regimen. Steve remembers when we did that, you know, regimen that's not going to lead to a whole bunch of resistance. And then I'd wait for Fostemsavir MK-8591. On the other hand, if their CD4 is 50, then yeah, maybe you'll need to do it and just do the best you can. I mean, we got people over the hump with infuvertide, so it's possible. But I think it's a clinical decision. I would not do it if the CD4 was high, if they had no other active drug. I would definitely wait.
Okay, so similarly, if a patient initially responded to induction, but then their viral load goes up again when they get on the maintenance dose, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Or if they have a toxicity, what do you do? Because they have drugs in their system, are you gonna? I think the in the studies anyway, what we didn't have to do this, but what we were told to do is that you could go ahead and give them oral nucleosides and an oral integrase inhibitor if you felt that for some reason they were failing therapy. With the injectable. So far, we've only seen rilpivirine resistance, but I don't know about the phase 3 studies. I mean, we'll get a ton of data on the phase 3 studies, likely coming to a conference in March in Seattle, but we'll see.
Okay, and then are there evidence in the Gemini study that people with a CD4 count of less than 200 don't do as well?
Yeah, so there was a... an analysis of people less than 200 CD4, and the proportion less than 50 at 48 weeks was lower. However, none of those people, it wasn't due to a viral load greater than 50 at 48 weeks. It was due to various loss to follow-ups or exiting care. So I don't think there's a virologic concern, but there was that difference. So I think we have to pay attention to it. The numbers were small because if you so I would be very cautious with two-drug therapy with a low CD4 until we have more data. There's a
right there.
Thank you. Nice talk, Dr. Aaron. This summer we've seen some data on the vaccine, the Mosaic vaccine, and that looked very promising. What are your thoughts about using that for therapeutic use and combining it with antiretroviral? And is there any work around vaccine in terms of treatment or cure?
Yeah, so the question is whether in people where we have relatively limited options, could we use actually a vaccine plus treatment? Could a vaccine be that second active or third active drug? I think that's a great question. No one's proposed studying it that way. Interestingly, those of you who read the New England Journal saw that there are TB vaccines that actually seem to have some activity, and people are definitely talking about studying TB vaccines that way, where they might be part of oral therapy for people that are at high risk of failure. So I think it's worth thinking about. I think those data were promising. But the multiple injections, a lot of issues. But I think it's certainly a topic worth thinking about.
Is it time to start doing integrase resistance testing on all new patients?
Yeah, I think that's a cost issue. So far, we just published a paper from North Carolina, Tim Menza et al., M-E-N-Z-A, and it's less than 1%, and the Paul Sachs calculus would say you don't need to start doing it. On the other hand, if someone's not doing it, we're never going to find out. So, I think it's still kind of in specific settings. I mean, if you have I think in New York City they've had a few cases. But I think in general the answer is still no, especially if you have a kind of a cumulative budget and you need to figure out how to use your money wisely. So I wouldn't do it on that yet.
Okay, so do you use dolutegravir and 3TC ever at this time, or are you waiting?
Okay, so true confessions. Two Thursdays ago, I had a patient who was out of care for years. He'd been on a combination integrase, had stopped, had no resistance, and then fell out of care. His creatinine was 2.7, and his viral load was 2,000, and his CD4 was 348. I used dolutegravir 3TC for the first time in that patient.
And are there concerns about resistance emerging with long-acting drugs in terms of missing doses and having this long tail?
Yeah, I think that's a real serious concern, right? I mean, that if someone gets an injection and then we can't find them, they're going to have this long tail. It's nice that the half-lives of the two drugs are relatively similar, but they're not perfectly similar. And cabotegravir, especially in women, has quite a long tail. So I think that's a real concern, and I think that's why Steve was talking about, you know, we really are going to have to reach out to these people if we're going to work with very high-risk people. Some people who aren't high-risk, the people that are on our studies at UNC, they're mostly younger, they're not on any other medications, and they really don't like being on pills. They're not this kind of non-adherent folks or people that have trouble staying in care. They like not being on the pills. The other thing is that you don't have to do this forever, right? If someone has a new job and they're traveling all over the country, maybe they want to use an injectable for a year or two, or they're in a new living situation and they're not sure about their roommates and whether they can feel that their privacy is protected. Maybe they want to be in an injectable for a while. We'll have to think about how to do this stuff and move people on and off. So those are challenges that you guys will have, and we'll have fun thinking about it.
Great. Well, thank you very much.